Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We have watched the news in Kunduz. We have seen what is happening right now in Israel-Palestine with over 500 Palestinians injured in Israel and Jerusalem. That's happening. And we've watched, of course, unfold the Islamic State with the Russians now bombing the Islamic State, the conflicts between the U.S. and Russia over that, what the future will be. And so we really want to explore that and starting with that because I think the world in America is in a quandary about where to go and what to do with this immense growing power and how the world should respond to it. Returning with us is Dr. Adel Shamu, Associate Fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies, Senior Analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Wrote the book Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace, and blogs for waroorpeace.com. Good to have you back, Adel.
Thank you for having me.
And Loretta Napoliani joins us once again. She was with us last week, author of numerous books, the latest being Islamist Phoenix, Islamic State, and the Redrawing of the Middle East. She's an expert on terrorist financing and money laundering and advises local governments and more on these issues. And Loretta, welcome back to the program as well.
Thank you very much.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us by email at talk@steinershow.org. Jump onto our Facebook pages, tweet me at Mark Steiner, but do call in if you have ideas and thoughts, 410-319-8888 if you can. So, Loretta, I'll begin with you. I think that, you know, as we watch the bombing increase on the part of Russia, and of course you saw there was a big brouhaha today over violating twice Iranian airspace, I mean a Turkish airspace, that was reported in the papers. And you're best saying, oh, Russia is not bombing the Islamic State, and the certain British newspapers saying, yes, they were. Here are the pictures of them bombing central offices of the Islamic State. But I still think bombing or no bombing, we still don't have a strategy, have no idea what we're doing. It feels.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do not have an idea. And also, if you think about, you know, we have many enemies. So we have Assad, who technically speaking should be fighting against the Islamic State and all the other jihadist groups. Then we have the jihadist groups, who technically speaking should be fighting against the Islamic State. We're backing the jihadist groups, including, you know, the Kurds, of course, among which there is also the PKK, which is still in the terrorist list of the State Department and many other Western countries. And then, you know, the Russians are bombing the same kind of people that we are, you know, bankrolling, saying that in reality they need to do that to protect, you know, Assad, because the solution to this mess is putting back Assad in a position of power so that that will pacify the region, which is, of course, not true. So I would say that there is massive confusion, and Putin is doing whatever he wants without anybody actually having the strength or the power or even the consensus among, you know, the coalition group to stop him, because that is what is actually happening.
Adel.
Well, I want to put it in context of what happened in the Middle East. We have been in state of fighting terrorism, invading Iraq, all the way from Afghanistan to Libya. We are 7,000 miles away from this area or more. And look at the mess we have done in Iraq for absolutely no reason. They invaded the country and destroyed it and took it back at least 50 years. Look what happened to Libya. We said we are not trying to kill him. We did. And now it's in civil war, continuous civil war. The Sub-Saharan desert are all rising up through Islamic, whether it's ISIL or Al-Qaeda or other groups. Look at Sisi. We are supporting now a dictator of number one. And I made an error. I was very hopeful about
it. About the Egyptian president.
Sisi, the current.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Al-Sisi. Yeah. So, and if you look at the Afghanistan, is really not doing that great either. So what happens is from the beginning of Arab Springs 5 years ago, 2010, we attempted to hijack and with the help of $7 to $8 billion Saudi's money to hijack really the Syrian revolution. There was a real revolution in the first year, and I've written articles supporting that revolution, and Bashar al-Assad, I was hoping he will disappear. However, it was hijacked, and now there are literally hundreds of groups in Syria. We don't know who they belong to. They are mostly al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, and other groups, extremists. The Free Syrian Army is really a creature of our intelligence services. They just got a general and a few hundred officers to follow him and soldiers. And that was it. So I'm saying is we are 7,000 miles away, and we go and bomb, send troops, invade. And then we are very surprised if Russia sends few bombing raids in Syria and maybe few hundred soldiers or 5,000 even soldiers. Why are we surprised? And I'm not surprised. I mean, why we should be only the one who can invade, who can occupy and interfere and hijack revolutions, while if any other country does it, I don't want the Russians to bomb in Syria. I don't want the Russians to occupy Syria. That's the last thing in the world I want. But I'm saying why we get surprised, the establishment media, not us, the establishment media, we all talk how bad Putin is. Well, is he worse than Bush?
Loretta?
That's a very good question, actually. Well, I would say that if we get into the war criminal kind of discussion, it's very difficult to say if one is bigger than the other. But the truth is I agree 100%. I mean, what is happening today is the consequences of the war on terror. If we had not done what we did, I mean, think about the Islamic State. It would not exist if we had not produced this super terrorist al-Zarqawi. We created the mythology of al-Zarqawi. The guy was a nobody. And then, it was sufficient that the United States, said, well, al-Zarqawi is the link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, which of course was not true, to turn it into the super terrorist. So the Islamic State traces its origins to the group that then became the strongest group in Iraq, headed by al-Zarqawi. Al-Baghdadi, the caliph, fought with it. So, yes, it is our creation. But I think we have to go beyond what has happened. We need to find a solution today because, we have 3 million people. So, I mean, today the Turkish government actually said that the estimates are that in the next 12 months we'll have 3 million additional people on the gates of Europe trying to get into Europe, refugees. So we need a solution, and this solution cannot be letting Putin bomb Syria. Absolutely not.
I'm agreeing with you. I said I don't like the Russians bombing Syria, but however, we sort of putting a condition on how we will move forward, and that is Bashar al-Assad has to be a number one in the agenda, that he has to leave. Well, Bashar al-Assad, if he didn't stay in power, 30 to 40% of population were under risk of being killed by other forces, especially the Christians. And so one reason Assad didn't go away that easily, because nearly half of the population at the beginning supported him.
So let me talk about the complexity of what you just raised. And first of all, just deal with the question of Russia very quickly. But I want to come back to the present, future, and historic complexity that the world is facing in the Middle East and many Arab and Muslim countries are facing at this moment. When you said, Loretta, when you mentioned the Russian bombing, I mean, what could be? I mean, there's no way to stop the Russians from doing what they're doing unless you directly confront them militarily, and that's not going to happen. At least we hope it's not going to happen, because that could lead to a conflagration that we can only fear in the deepest parts of ourselves. So what can you really do? You can't really negotiate. At this point, they're not going to stop the bombing.
No,
not going to happen.
I mean, sorry.
No, go ahead, Loretta.
Yes. Did you say I should answer?
Yes.
Sorry. Well, the truth is that we are hedging very, very close to a confrontation.
Yes, yes.
On the skies of yes. The NATO, the border between NATO and Russia. I mean, there's been a lot of similar incidents to the one we've seen in Turkey in the last 24 hours in the Baltic republics. So that would be terrible. That would be a disaster. If actually two planes would shoot each other down, one from NATO and the other one from Russia. So there is also this element that we're not taking into consideration. We're very close to a point in which these two powers, so the West on one side and Russia on the other side, will get to a sort of breakdown of relationship. Let's not forget, we put sanction on Russia. I mean, the trade between Russia and Europe has been deeply, deeply disrupted by the sanctions that have been imposed after the situation in the Ukraine degenerated. And, of course, Putin took back part of that country. So we forget that because we see them at the United Nations all together taking a picture, right? Saying, oh, well, they're having discussion. Well, in reality, the relationship between the West and Russia have never been so bad since the end of the Cold War. And that is not good for Europe and the West in general. And I would say it's not good for the world either.
Well, I want to be a little more cynical. What happens is when you had unipolar, you're right, there was no problem. We were like Genghis Khan. We're going over wherever we want and do whatever we wish to do and kill whoever with drones or bombs, and there was nobody pushing us back. I mean, that's the reason there was no problem, really, with Russia or China. China is not strong enough to face us, and plus they don't want to disrupt their economy now. They want another 20 years, so they will be in par with us. Russia has nuclear weapon. That's the only one, the only thing they have they could threaten us with. So there was no check, really, to our power. You see, President Obama, flaw, he has a lot of good intentions, but his flaw is that he doesn't want to send troops. But he adopted the same Bush policy, but without sending boots on the ground. But at the same time, what he's doing really the same thing Bush would have done by in terms of bombing and invasion and having special forces everywhere.
But let me just push back a little bit on both, a little bit. I mean, because the different – I agree with you in many aspects what you're saying, Adel, but we're also facing a world that was created in the last 15 years that exploded – stability, quote unquote, in the Middle East, and I think America is stuck in some ways. Just to end it, what would that mean? I mean, let me just take it back for a second. Let's take it back 700 years, because I think it's important for context for our listeners. I'm going to go open the phones. Jason, we're going to come to your call first at 410-319-8888. But for 600 years, what the Ottoman Empire, out of modern Turkey, controlled most of the Middle East. In, except for Afghanistan, most of the Middle East and the Near East that we're talking about that was in conflict, that's in conflict now.
Mm-hmm.
And those parts of the world, the Ottoman Empire, when they controlled it, whether it was where modern day Iraq is, or Syria, or Libya, or wherever those countries were, it was in some ways allow those places to govern themselves internally as long as they can control it externally,
mm-hmm.
right? Or local forces at any rate. Mm-hmm. And so then you have World War One. Just quick history for our listeners. You
sure,
have World War One.
Absolutely.
World War One. The Ottoman Empire loses to the West, and the West, Britain and France and America divide up the responsibility for the Arab Muslim world
sure.
and take over. But then you instill these strong men in that have been overthrown. Their monarchy is overthrown. Create new strong men mm-hmm. in the last 50 years. So I mean, and that was the world we had until you blew up. Until we blew up Hussein
That's
in Iraq and blew up Gaddafi in Libya and are now we're blowing up Assad in Syria. All three nations being nations that are – all three men being in regimes that were just horrendous and horrible. But the stability you blew up has caused the anarchy we're seeing now. So, I mean, I'm just – that's the context we're seeing. So it's just that it's like this kind of authoritarian life for 700 years and chaos. And that's what we're facing. And I think that's why I think it's so hard for people to put their hands around, because the historical reality doesn't lend itself to easy solutions to what we've created in the last 15 years. That's what I'm saying.
Well, we have a policy of regime change. It's a policy. And so we, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense during the invasion of Iran, said one thing very honest. He said, we had on a piece of paper 12, 13 reasons why we're going to invade Iraq. We just chose the weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
So the goal, the initial goal is to accomplish regime change. The reason, we will make it up basically as we go on, because there are multiple reasons, you know, and that's what happened. We are still in that mode. This is where I'm disappointed with Obama. Assad, it's none of our business to do regime change in Syria. The people of Syria, through their own internal struggle, they could have removed...
I'm not sure about that.
Oh, I think they could have removed
maybe,
him.
Maybe, perhaps.
Yeah, they could have removed him.
Perhaps.
But having a foreign troops and foreign bombs, do you think that helps? That made it worse. And that's why nobody talks about Saudi Arabia. They're the one who funneled, within the first 2-3 years, $7 billion to buy weapons for every group under the sun. And it turned out most of them are Al-Qaeda and their supporters. So I'm saying is, now what we're doing, we're making the same mistake. We're saying Bashar al-Assad must go. Who in the heck are we to tell other leaders to must go? Really, why? Why can't Russia do that? Or Britain or France?
Or anybody else.
Yeah.
So, Loretta, let me let you jump in at this point, because I think I was trying to lay out kind of historical complexity. What are your thoughts?
I think it's interesting your analysis about, you know, the Ottoman Empire and dictatorship versus, you know, anarchic chaos, political chaos. I mean, in reality, the real strength of the Islamic State vis-a-vis all the other armed organizations, the jihadist armed organizations, it's been the fact to present itself as a state. So having a very sound nation-building project, which has been implemented since the creation of the caliphate. Now, that, I think, is extremely interesting, very important, because it is the Muslim political utopia. It is a dream that the Muslim world has had, exactly for 700 years. Because, I mean, after the fall of the caliphate, there is nothing, politically speaking. So there is the Ottoman Empire, and then there are these regimes which are imposed to the local population by Western powers, either after World War One or World War Two. So for centuries, the Muslims have been dreaming about creating their own state, expressing themselves politically, through something similar to the European nation state. I mean, they had great admiration, for example, for at the beginning, for the European nation state. So the Islamic State is capturing this dream, is capturing this this fantasy to a certain extent, and is saying, well, here we are. This is your state. I mean, forget Assad, forget, you know, Saudi Arabia, you know, forget the West. This is your patriotic call to arms, because, you know, this is your only chance to create your own nation. And I think we have missed that out completely, totally, because, you know, the propaganda that we have projected, and also that we have used to convince ourselves, was, well, you know, the Islamic State is like Al-Qaeda, you know, people that want to go back to the 6th century Arabia, they're backward individuals. Well, actually, no. I mean, this is a modern nation project. It is the 21st century caliphate. So that's why it's so successful.
Very quickly, then we'll go to the phones here.
Well, I don't subscribe because the Ottoman Empire was a dictatorship, and therefore the people are used to dictatorship, etc. There was many rebellions against the Ottoman Empire. Salah ed-Din was a very successful rebel who carved out a whole nation for himself. So that's really not true. No, the Arabs and Muslims are not used to strong men, and therefore that's how they're created. Those strong men were appointed by the Brits and the French.
Speaking as an Arab Democrat.
Yes, an Arab Democrat, exactly. And so... Having said that, the reason the Islamic movement, the Islamic State, which is capturing, it's capturing the imagination. And I'm, you know, me, I've written extensively on how bad they are and how nihilistic they are, etc. But they have captured the imagination of the Muslim youth and old people as well, because they all the time yearned, and Loretta alluded to it, yearned for that glory of the 10th century, 11th century Arab empire and the technology, etc. They have contributed to civilizations. However, that mentality of the people in Arab world, that they are only good, that's how they look at themselves. We are only good to provide oil for the West. And the indignity, you should see the indignity of human beings. It hasn't been worse since, I'm 74 years old, I haven't been worse since my entire life. The indignity of the Arabs, how they've been stepped upon by the West and did not respect their views whatsoever.
Let me open the phones here, and I have come back to questions a little bit, let you respond as well. But let me go to the phones. I promise to do that. 410-319-8888. Jason, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Mike. Thanks so much for the march.
That's right.
I was just going to comment on Russia and Russia's support of Bashar Assad. I just really feel that I think the U.S. is seriously making a mistake by saying that Bashar Assad has to leave, because I really feel that I think if he falls, the U.S. has put all their like eggs in the basket of these modern Syrians that we can't find. Like, you know, we spent billions of dollars to train something like 40 people. And I think if Assad leaves, I think Syria's gone. I think it's going to go to ISIS. And I also think Jordan's going to be next. And if Jordan falls, what's going to happen, you know, where else do you go? I think Syria is going to have to be the line that I think a lot of the West or a lot of Middle Eastern countries are going to have to hold the line, because I just think if it falls, then that's it.
Jason, I think you raise a... Did I cut you off? Did you finish your thought?
No, I'm done. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Thanks for holding on. And I think that Jason makes a very strong point, Loretta, and seeing the kind of unraveling here.
Yeah, I mean, of course, he made a very strong point. It is true that a removal of Assad doesn't guarantee that there will be a better regime, or even in a friendly regime to us, because look what's happened in Libya. We have, you know, 1,200 armed organizations. The country is in total chaos. I mean, you could say that Libya is a failed state. I mean, there are two governments, one on one hand and one on the other hand of the country, that claim to be the legitimate government. So here we are. And yes, it is also true that the Islamic State can only gain from this kind of chaos. But I don't see an alternative, even if hypothetically the U.S. would say, yes, let's now, you know, back Assad. After, you know, 5 years of civil war, you're not going to get the kind of consensus in the Middle East that is required for the area to be pacified behind this leadership. We've gone too far. So we need to find a different solution. And this different solution most probably has to be a solution that comes from the region, so not intervention from outside. And with outside, I would include also the Gulf states, because it is true that, you know, this war by proxy in Syria, that started with the Arab Spring and then degenerated into a civil war and then a war by proxy, has been funded by the Gulf states. So Saudi Arabia being, you know, the number one. So perhaps that could be a solution, just to let them sort themselves out in the region without our intervention.
But they are not letting us to do that at all. I mean, the Saudis and the United States are determined to determine the outcome of what happened in Syria. We are not really hands-off anymore, even when Russia wasn't there. 3 years ago, almost there was an agreement, by the way, on a peaceful transition. And Assad will not leave, but the road to leaving will be maybe in 5-10 years. We rejected it.
Let me open the phones. I have a question here from something that Loretta wrote, and I'm just curious, sure, both your takes on something that she posited. 410-319-8888, Kadria, online one, you're on the air. Welcome. Hey, Kadria, could you turn down your phone so we can hear you? I mean, your radio, excuse me.
319-8888, Kadria.
Kadria, could you turn down, can you try the radio so we can hear you? There you go.
Number one, let me just get this out the way, number one. For this gentleman and this woman who apparently are from the so-called Middle East to align themselves with this country and say we are bombing, okay? No one asked minorities in this country their opinion of nothing. Number two, whoever said it was not the United States' business or Russia's business what other people do is more than right, but this is their race to feel you can rule the world and so they condemn one another back and forth. It is the same thing back and forth, colonialization of the non-white people of the earth who outnumber them far. And the only way they can do that is because they keep deceiving us and we keep going for it. The lady just talked about the Ottoman Empire and the puppets that's put into the countries by the British. These are more Caucasian people. I want to know when we're going to wake up, stop aligning ourselves with these sadistic people, and realize that they are who they are and we are who they are, and we need to go
separate. Thank you, Kadra. Thank you. I honestly do think it goes beyond just the question of race and who people are, because if you go to the Middle East, it's difficult to tell who anybody is in terms of the racial spectrum we created in the West.
I agree. but you see Arabs with blue eyes and blonde hair sometimes.
Sometimes. And you see Arab people who are clearly African.
That's right.
One of the things that Reda, you said once, at least I didn't misread the article, I would like you just to kind of talk a bit about this, is that you wrote about the idea that ISIS being for the Sunnis what Israel is for the Jews, especially post-Civil War, or post-World War II. Could you talk a bit about that theory?
Well, I mean, this is how they present themselves. I mean, the creation of Israel was very important for all the Jews, because that state, you know, the simple fact that the state existed would provide deliverance from centuries and centuries of persecution. Israel is the protector of all the Jews all over the world. So this is how the idea was pursued, and this is how the idea was also implemented. Well, the Islamic State is doing the same thing. I mean, it's, of course, it's selecting a group of Muslims. So we're talking about the Sunni, we're talking also the Salafists, so the radical Salafists. So it is one sector, not, you know, the entire Muslim world. However, if you convert, you can belong to that. And the message is the same. It's, you know, you have been oppressed for centuries and centuries, either at home by dictatorship or the Ottoman Empire or the colonizer, or, you know, in the West, being immigrants. And now you have the possibility to create a state which is going to offer you deliverance from all of these centuries of oppression. And at the same time, for the future, this is a state that will protect you. So you can come here. This is your state. This is the first words that the caliph said to the people when, you know, there was the ceremony for, you know, the creation of the caliphate. This is your state. Come and join us. So that is the message. And this is why it's such a strong political and religious message at the same time, because he has this very strong patriotic and nationalistic element. And it's working, because, you know, we see all this, I mean, especially in Europe, we see all these young people, women also with small children wanting to go there. It's incomprehensible to us. But when you look at this call from this point of view, you realize how seductive it is. This is what we actually need to work on, to stop something like that.
Well, I think this is consistent with what I said earlier, is the indignity the Arabs and Muslims have faced for centuries, and the oppression by foreign colonizers. And now they are yearning to be free from the West and use their own oil rather than foreigners take it. And at the same time, they yearn to their past glory. That may be delusion or not. That's reality. So I agree with Loretta. Those are the reasons why they are so popular. However, that's why changing the status quo, what do we do with ISIL or ISIS, it's not going to be simply by foreign invasions or foreign interference like we are now and now the Russians, but we've been doing it for a long time, for decades. And that's not going to work. It's going to be worse and worse and worse unless the region themselves find a solution.
But let's talk about what that means, find a solution, what that means. I mean, we talk about the attraction that the Islamic State has for Muslim youth, especially, but and it's some Muslim youth, not even a majority of young Muslim people anywhere in the world. I mean, there are people who, when stories come out of the parts of Iraq and Syria that they control, what happens to women, the beheadings, the forced marriages, this is not the way of life of most people who live in the Muslim world or who are Muslims in the world. And so, I mean, but you heard there was a report this morning on Morning Edition on public radio, National Public Radio, about the Iraqi army frustrated because they don't have the weaponry or the power, and the corruption inside the military will not allow them to take on and push back the Islamic State in Iraq because they have no power to do it. And in part, we've created a situation. So what is that response? I mean, is our response to then give the Iraqi army more weapons? Is our response to walk away and say, well, we created this, now we have nothing left to do with it? I mean, what is our response?
I have said that
many
times.
I mean the United States, since we are Americans.
I have written and I have talked to so many people about it during after the invasion all the way now. Have you noticed America never gave Iraq an air force? Nobody pays attention to that.
Israel,
that was intentional. Exactly. Not even a simple air force. They didn't get zero. They had zero. They're zero air force. So what I'm saying is whatever we gave them enough just basically for police action against their own people, not really to defend the nation. And that's still is an outcome of what we did. It's unfortunate to bring it back to us, but that's an outcome. That's by design.
Loretta?
Yes, I mean, I agree. I mean, they don't have aviation, but nevertheless, in the summer 2014, they dropped the weapons and everything in Mosul and ran. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that this is the best army that we have in the Middle East. It's also a sort of very sectarian army because, in reality, Iraq has been ruled by the Shia since, you know, the invasion. The Shia have, with the debatification, let's not forget, the debatification, what's happened there, that, you know, from one day to the next, the entire police force and all the army was dismissed.
But, so you know, I hate to blame America first. I really do. But at the same time, that sectarianism, which, by the way, was third or fourth priority in the culture of Iraq, we created it by putting together a government of the provisional authority based on Kurds, Sunni, Arabs, Christians, and we give them land, power, and money based on that proportion. So we created, we surfaced that kind of sectarianism, and we give them money and weapons based on that. Of course it's gonna be functioning now.
I'm sorry, Laura, finish the thought before we have to close out.
The real problem has been that the willingness of the Shia government was to transform the army into a sort of Shia militia, which in reality this is what they did. So we do not have the participation of the other people in the army. We also have people badly trained, and also people that were trained simply because they could get a salary. So there is not a true army in Iraq. So it doesn't surprise me.
You get motivated by having a cause.
Excuse me, can I finish, please?
Sorry.
Yeah, we have a minute left. We have to end. We have to end this in one minute, literally.
And in any case, it was the responsibility of Iraq to get its own aviation, to get its own police, to get its own army. I mean, we're not there, you know, to nanny them all the way. I mean, the United States spent $42 billion to arm and train the Iraqi army, only for the Islamic State, you know, to walk basically into Mosul without firing one single shot. So this is the reality on the ground. I mean, there are 200,000 people fighting with the Islamic State today, and about 80,000 in the entire Iraqi army.
We're just about out of time here at the moment. Yeah. So you have like 30 seconds. 30, yes. Literally, 30, we have to end.
Yeah. Well, people fight well throughout the history if they are motivated, whether it's due to Islamic calling or due to nationalistic or revolutionary fervor. The Iraqi people have no motivation and no desire to fight for the Americans. Why should they? And that's really what it is to them. They're not fighting for Iraq. They're fighting for foreign invader.
I want to thank
because
you.
Because Maliki was selected by us.
So we could go on for a long time, but we will come back to this. And it's good to have you both here, Dr. Adil Shamu and Loretta Napoliani. Thank you both so much for being here. We'll attach on our website, steinershow.org, to the books they've both written and the work they're doing. I want to thank you both so much for taking time with our listeners today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Loretta. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. Dave On Love and Tawanda Jones join us as we look at West Wednesdays and what is coming up next and why, and then meet a candidate for mayor of Baltimore City, one I've not met yet and I'm looking forward to meeting. Stay with us.